This is the Fun, Food and Fitness Podcast, where I have real conversations about how people navigate BS and establish a healthy relationship with food, exercise and their bodies. So welcome to the Fun, Food and Fitness Podcast. My name's Emma Green, and today I'm really, really excited to be speaking with Camilla Dempster, who is a lifestyle and fitness coach and a pain management therapist and an advocate of self-respect and moderation. So welcome to the podcast, Camilla.
Hi, Emma. Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I don't know if we should mention maybe like how we met, actually. I was just thinking, it was over a year ago, maybe?
It feels like I've known you forever.
Yeah.
I think, through the health bloggers community, I think, originally.
Yeah.
And did we get in contact over doing some Instagram lives together?
Yes.
And then...
And we did. Yeah, we had a little chat. It was great. We just, I think, realised like we're really like-minded, and I know what you mean. It does seem like forever, and I think with social media sometimes it's like that, because you kind of see each other's like content all the time and things. So very much kind of on the same page with all the stuff, which is why I'm sure we'll have a great conversation. So just to start, really, I was just wondering if you could just talk a bit about your kind of story. Obviously you're a coach, but kind of, you know, your own kind of personal journey with health and fitness as well.
Yeah, sure. I'll try and keep it as succinct as possible, because I think, you know, whenever we each tell our own stories, it's quite easy to kind of go into like a lot of depth.
Mm.
So I'm going to go into kind of like three of the main stages of like my journey, both like personally and then my coaching journey as well, and where that's taken me. So my personal story started actually when I was 15. So I went to a school where they weighed us every term to make sure that we weren't having eating disorders. And I can't think of anything more likely to produce eating disorders than weighed us at school. Anyway, through a summer, because I was very inactive as a teenager, through a summer I ate so much food. I came back to school, and in September when they weighed me, the nurse, she said to me, "Right, Cam, you're clinically obese now." And I was like, "Oh, okay." Didn't realise. Consequently, we had these lessons at school called PHSC, and they were talking about eating disorders, and I was like, you know what? That's a really cool way to lose weight, bulimia, because you can eat all the food, throw it up, and still lose weight. So that really is where my relationship with food and fitness and lifestyle started. It's almost like a very backwards place, because I started from a place of being almost 100 kilograms at 5'5". That's substantial. I was a size 18 to 20 in UK sizes. And I desperately wanted to be smaller, thinner, to be able to, in my mind, fit into a mold of, you know, what a teenager should be. You know, if I could have friends, it's because I'm thin. If I want to be sociable, it would be because I was thin and, you know, attractive. And I really started to base my self-worth upon how I looked and how I felt. That journey, actually, through the bulimia and being affected by weight and all this continued for a long, long time. And I'll kind of jump ahead a bit here, because I did go to uni and I did some stuff and I worked in an office for a bit. But then got to this point where I was 21 and I was training all the time. I loved the gym. And one of my friends in the gym, she was a PT, a personal trainer, and she goes, "You know, Cam, like, you're here so often, why don't you like retrain?" And I was like, yes. What a good idea. If I become a personal trainer, I will be fit. I will learn how to control my body and therefore how I feel about it and therefore feeling good enough. I basically became a personal trainer at that point to really, yes, help other people not go through what I was going through, but also to learn for myself how to get out of it. And I was really lucky. Once I trained, I got some amazing jobs. I worked for David Lloyd, which is really, you know, it's a national chain of gyms here in the UK. And and they spend a lot of energy educating you. So I kind of took full advantage of that and scaled the corporate ladder within David Lloyd to the point of management, and then even training trainers to become trainers. All throughout this period, bear in mind this, I was still bulimic and still relating my self-worth and even my ability to be a trainer to my size. And I would have these massive highs where I was training loads, eating really well, and feeling on top of the world, followed by these ultimate depressing lows where I just, you know, something would snap and I would be hungry and I would binge, and then I would not be able to stop myself, and I would go into this kind of like deep hole of, I'm not good enough, I can't be a trainer, I can't believe I'm not successful. I just, my whole worth for a 10-year period from basically 15 to 25 was based upon how thin I was and consequently how good I felt at life, which really brings me on to the third kind of like major point in my life, which I want to talk about, is it was actually during the recession, and I'd bought a house, couldn't afford it, and I thought to myself, I'm either going to get repossessed and made bankrupt, or I'm going to move out of this house, move into my mum's, and rent it out, which I did. Lasted a couple of months at my mum's, and I was like, I literally can't do this. So I googled personal training jobs abroad, and I found an opportunity to move to the Middle East, Kuwait precisely, where I opened a gym, a female only gym, and had a lot of space away from my life, which enabled me really to reflect upon things and begin working on myself. So this was really like the turning point from that, I would say, girl who was very insecure and concerned about how she looks and weighs and all of these things, to becoming this powerful, strong and confident woman who believes in herself, doesn't matter on her size, doesn't matter on whether she fits into the clothes, doesn't matter if she fits into like society's generalization of how I should look, but more so about, you know, what I can provide for other people and how I can be my best. And I really, yeah, I just spent then the next sort of 7 years, I'm 32 now, so it must be 7 years, with professional development and really working on myself to let go of all of this baggage, and transform my life. And that really is my whole journey, is shaped where I am now, is like right now what I do is teach women to ditch the binge, guilt, restrict cycle and really just live their best life. And I know, as I say that, I know it sounds so cliche, but I honestly believe if we all felt that we were worthy of what we have and we can each live in the present moment, we will all be so much happier, so much more content, and therefore so much more able to just do what we want, get the job we want, get the relationship we want, travel as much as we want, have all the adventure. Like, it's a very holistic way of looking at things. And I think instead of, you know, going back to that thought process of 10 to 15 years ago where worth is reflected on size, now worth is reflected on literally your own definition of what that is. I work with women to allow them to define who they want to be, how they're going to get there, and then guide them to be able to do that.
Oh, that is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. There's like so much I want to like just dig into there, I think.
Like I said, it's a long story. I tried to keep it succinct, but I think I've been chatting for quite a while.
Yeah. It's all good. First I just want to dig back into the, like, when you were at school, you said you were like 15, and this like idea of being like weighed at school, I just think, oh my god, like I had it was like every year, but I think you said every term or something, right? I mean,
yeah, so I went to a boarding school, and it was an all girls boarding school, and let me say, I think in my year of 48 people, 40 of them were boarders and from other countries. So consequently, I guess the school did have a responsibility to make sure that all the girls were healthy and they weren't having eating disorders. However, I, looking back at that situation now, and I see more and more people and because I, you know, my age group, like all my friends, like having kids and stuff now, I see more and more of my friends talk about how their kids are getting weighed at school, and they're shocked by it and outraged, really, because it does promote this comparison within the year group. And I remember you'd come out of this room where you've been weighed, and you'd have like everyone be like, well, how much did you weigh then? How much did you weigh then? And again, especially because I was in this school that quite frankly had quite a lot of Cantonese and Chinese people in it, their bone structure is very different from mine, so of course they are going to be a lot lighter. And it really bred this comparison between women, and almost like a competition of who could be the smallest. And you know, actually even sometimes it was, if you were too light and you needed monitoring, you'd have to go back every week or every month until that they were sure that you weren't being anorexic or bulimic, etc. That was almost a point of pride for some people, that they were the ones who were so skinny and so small that they had to be called back in each week to be measured. God. So it was really the start of something which was so, so negative. And not just for myself, I've spoken to lots of my friends now, and it's been extremely negative for everyone. So, whenever I hear people now talking about their kids who are getting weighed at school, it's like major alarm bells for me. And I just want to scream at the top of my lungs, like, go speak to that school and don't let them do it to your kids, like, at all. It's one of the worst things which can initiate disordered eating I have ever experienced.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's funny, I had like a very similar experience in terms of like this being this kind of comparison thing. And I think just this like making like you have an increased preoccupation with it, you know? And I think especially like that age, like for me, I was kind of like 14 when I sort of started driving, you said 15. I just think we've got so much going on at that age to kind of worry about anyway. And, you know, your body is naturally changing, and it's just, yeah. I mean, I that is something I do have some concerns about in terms of the way that we are thinking about health in terms of the kind of public sphere of things. And particularly when it comes to children, I am concerned that in this sort of quest to, you know, tackle the quote-unquote obesity epidemic, that actually we are setting children up to have potentially quite disordered relationships with food and their bodies, I think, you know.
Yeah, 100% agree. But I do believe this relationship with food, we have a sphere of influence around us. And so I closely influence like my close friends and family, and, you know, influence as well the people who I coach or are following me on social media. But if we are all responsible within the sphere of influence, even if that's just your parents, your sisters, your nieces, your nephews, your own kids, even if that's your sphere of influence, if we each take a responsibility for that sphere, I'm going to say it and I'm going to get tongue-tied in a minute, but if we all take responsibility for that sphere of influence and model the behavior that is beneficial. So what I mean here is, if I influence just my close friends and family, if I am constantly dieting and comparing myself to them or external people, or, you know, just doing habits that are limiting me, the people in my sphere are also going to see that, and they're also going to replicate that. And it's especially true when it comes to children. Whereas if we behave responsibly in that sphere and we nourish ourselves with good movement, we nourish ourselves with good food, and we really care for ourselves with self-care and mindfulness, if we are a really brilliant role model for that small sphere of influence, those people then will model for their sphere. And then before we know it, it's like we're paying forward this amount of responsibility and care for the people around us that becomes exponential. So I really think here, if there's a mum listening who's concerned about, you know, a small child up to a teenager, up to an older child, someone, anyone, if you're concerned about their behavior and their relationship with food, instead of stigmatizing it and focusing on it and speaking to them about it in a way that maybe helps them feel defensive about it and excludes you from it, I would say, take a look at your own relationship with food and see how you can model what you want them to do so that you can influence them in a beneficial way.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think that is huge. I think we all, like you say, we all have this amount of influence, you know, regardless of if we're on social media or not, right? I think we, you know, like you say, in our just our day-to-day lives, we do. And I do think, you know, with eating disorders, we do know there is a kind of genetic component, you know, and for me, I had very healthy behaviours, like modelled, but still kind of had, you know, difficulties. And I think that kind of goes on to one of the other things that I was kind of wanting to dig in with you is kind of this this thing that actually, although the focus is on our food or body, but actually it's much deeper than that. You know, it is about this kind of control and not feeling good enough and stuff. And I don't know, I don't feel that people always understand that. Do you know what I mean? I think it's easy for it to, we focus on the surface level stuff, you know?
Well, yeah, 100% agreed. And I think until, like, personally, I tell you, it's like in my story, personally, I didn't realize it was something deeper until I started to unravel that story. So when my mother, she found out that I was bulimic, she actually went to the school nurse, because I told her the story of the nurse told me I was obese and I needed to do something about it. She went to the school nurse, spoke to the nurse about it and asked for some advice. And the nurse, so his advice was, you know, to get me to go and have some therapy. Mm-hmm. Now, my mum asked me, do you need therapy? And I was like, no, I just need to eat dinner. So I didn't understand that this eating disorder, I didn't understand that it was me trying to control how I felt about myself. I literally thought it was superficial. I thought it was, I want to lose weight and this was the way that I was going to do it. So instead of having an eating disorder, I'll diet. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I then went on to a severely calorie restricted diet, eating 600 to 800 calories a day. I didn't understand that it was about control and it was about so much more. And I think, like you said, it's so much more than one thing. But when we're in that situation, we're deep inside, it's very, very, very difficult to see from an outside perspective, looking in, to understand that it's about more than just needing to look a certain way. So,
yeah.
And that sometimes when you are deep in that hole, it's really difficult to hear that and understand it. And I think if anyone's at the point of coming to awareness that the eating disorder is not just about being smaller or being thinner or anything else, but it's about having control of your life in some manner, that right there, that's a turning point. Because if you have that awareness, you have the awareness to be able to overcome that thought process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think you're so right. When you're in it, you just can't see it, I think. And I mean, part of that even is just, I think your brain isn't physically functioning properly, right? Because you are essentially malnourished, you know? So I think that's part of this as well. And I think it's so true, because I think inherent to all kind of eating disorders, you know, is this element, I think, of denial for a while, where it's, you know, you're just kind of so caught in it. And I think these, you know, these behaviors and things, there's such a drive to do them, you know? And it's, I think, even when, you know, there's this idea of going to therapy or, you know, having some other type of help or whatever, this idea that almost like you're taking this away from me, like that, you know. And it's yeah, it is hard. But yeah, I think therapy is just amazing, honestly. I think like if everyone had therapy, like the world would be a better place, honestly. It's just And I think as well, you do get some real lasting kind of tools with therapy. You know, I think, like you said, once you've kind of got that awareness, I just think in general, then you have this, yeah, I guess it is like mindfulness in a way that kind of carries you through, you know, and
I've had a couple of therapists and people that I've worked with. I think it would be fair to say here, it would partially depend upon the therapist if they give you tools to work away with. So yeah. I think it's really important, if anyone was looking at having therapy, do that upon a recommendation. So you want to make sure you have a recommendation from a friend or, you know, some person that you trust, to make sure that you get a therapist who is actually really going to help you, not just whilst you're paying them, but also then afterwards. So like you said, you want a therapist who helps you go through all of these these limiting beliefs and patterns, but they're one who also gives you the tools to continue working on them and overcoming them when you're not paying them.
Yeah.
So I think that's a little sticking point that I have with therapy. Yes, it's brilliant, but in the wrong hands, and you know, potentially the less well-trained hands or the less responsible hands, it can be slightly non-beneficial. So always go for a therapist with a recommendation.
Yeah, I agree. And it is tricky, I think, with eating disorders, because I think, you know, we have this culture in this country that everything can be fixed with CBT, right? Which is cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think whilst that's great for some people, I don't think it always gives people the tools to be okay once that's kind of finished, you know. And it's also, it's very, or at least, you know, my experience of studying it and having it personally is that it is very focused specifically on these thoughts around kind of food and exercise and your body, and doesn't necessarily give you that bigger picture perspective, you know. So I agree. I think it is sometimes a case of, you know, looking around for different options, different types of therapies, different therapists, you know. And I think if it is affordable, often going private sometimes is the best thing to do, you know, depending on what's available. So no, I agree, because I think that's the thing. Therapy is potentially a great tool, but can not only in some cases be, you know, just not sort of do anything, but actually can in some cases even be harmful, I think, depending on. I mean, I spoke to someone and it sounded awful. They said they had a therapist who was like looking at the clock during their like appointments and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, like how, you know, you're already there. You already probably have a low sense of kind of self-esteem and self-worth and stuff. And you're just having that like reinforced by, you know, by a therapist. It's just, you know, so yeah, I would completely agree with that. And in terms of, so if you're in the UK, in terms of eating disorder specifically, I think BEAT is actually a really, really good resource for finding support. So, and I believe in America, I think they have, I think it's NEDA, I think. So I think those associations can be quite good if you don't have anyone in your circle who can recommend someone. So no, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
I just want to touch on here as well that, you know, again, when I had these classes at school about eating disorders, it was always displaying pictures of people who were very skeletal. And I think it's worth just bearing in mind here that you can have an eating disorder that doesn't necessarily look like you have an eating disorder. Like, I remember at one point, just at, you know, probably about a year before I had this transformation, and I was out in town having a drink, and I was chatting to this guy, and he said to me, like, what do you do? And I said, I'm a personal trainer. And he laughed and he said, you don't look like a trainer. Because I was like, you know, a bit too soft and a bit too chubby at this point. And I just, you know, remember thinking to myself, like, you literally have no idea that I have an eating disorder, and you're making these comments about my body, and it's purely based on looks. So I think it's really important to understand that eating disorders come in many shapes and forms, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to look skeletal. So, you know, it's just worth having that awareness about the situation as well.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and it's interesting actually, because for me, it was anorexia I struggled with, and there was definitely a part of me when I had some awareness of what was going on that I liked the fact that I had this almost like visible badge that I wasn't okay. Like, it was, it would sound so messed up, but it was like, because I didn't yet have the awareness or the language or whatever to really articulate what was going on, or maybe the courage to say, actually, I'm not okay. But there was, do you know what I mean? There was like a part of me that actually almost wanted the kind of, you know, it was sort of almost like a cry for help in a way, without me having to do anything. It's, I don't know. It's, but yeah, like you say, it's it is so important to, I think, you know, to remind people of that. And also, you know, as you go through recovery, sometimes, you know, you will sort of look different, and that isn't necessarily indicative of what's going on, you know, inside. So no, I think that is so important to you know, to communicate. And obviously, you know, we've talked about anorexia and bulimia, but I mean, there's a whole category of other kind of different conditions. You know, at the moment we get lumped in the DSM-5 into I think EDNOS, which is like eating disorder not otherwise specified, but within that, you know, there's things like orthorexia and all these different types of things. So yeah, I think that is you know, that is important. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, it's yeah, it's so complex, these things, I think, and it's so messy. And I think but I think it's really good now that I do feel that having conversations about them is becoming more common, you know.
It's very visible, especially and you know, social media is a double-edged sword. You can have some amazing accounts on social that make you aware of these kind of conversations, but then, you know, you also have accounts on social media which even are pro anorexia or pro bulimia. We have all of these different types of things. So yes, it's, you know, we have all of this brilliance out there opening the conversation, but it's just being aware of, like, making sure we pick the right people to kind of like follow and have an awareness of. So
yeah, I agree, because I even see some stuff that I'm sure is kind of really well intentioned, but just is kind of a version of health that I really don't see as healthy, you know, this kind of super, you know, if we're going to call it clean eating, you know, kind of punishing yourself at the gym, you know, if you have a cake, you go and burn it off, you know, this kind of stuff. And yeah, there is a lot of that out there, I think.
Even a very, and I'm not going to mention the name of the brand, but even a very well-known sportswear brand last year launched a jumper which said something along the lines of, like, pain first, or like running pain first, champagne next, or after, or something. Oh. Some like BS like this. And I was just like, are you serious? You are literally a national brand. It's like selling punishment before treat. And I could not think of anything more disruptive to overall health. And again, this brand is very much associated with holistic wellness. And it was just very surprising to me that actually sometimes we have these messages in our face and we don't even realize it, because it's such a mainstream media that we have literally no idea of it.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And I think even sometimes when things are like, you know, well-intentioned, you know, like there's like, you know, you see a lot on social media, like strong, not skinny. And it's like, well, actually, like, is that really what we're saying? Like, yes, great, mental strength, physical strength, whatever. But then like bashing like another body type, like surely that's not the way to fix the issue, is it at all, you know?
And you can be really strong if you're skinny, like whatever your body gives you. So yeah, 100% agreed. Sometimes these well-intentioned processes and media can be non-beneficial. So we just have to be careful how we consume it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, as well, you know, as people on social media do think about how we communicate messages as well, I think, you know, because this, like I said, this stuff is, you know, it's messy, it's complex, it's nuanced, you know. So but I think as much as we can, thinking about the kind of potential impact that you know, our kind of content can have, you know, both positive and negative, I think is, you know, is important. You know, I think especially with, you know, platforms like, you know, Instagram, I mean, anyone can go onto an Instagram page, for example. They don't have to have an account, anyone can see it. So yeah, that is something, you know, I'm sure you're kind of mindful of, and I try to be, you know, too, because I just think it's
so, like, another part of something that I do obviously is helping, I do help women who have blogs who are trying to increase their influence and their impact. And it's one of the things that actually we touch upon, because it is so prevalent of, you might not even like realize when you're writing a caption out of an Instagram post, for example, that the phrasing is negative to a different type of person. So it's actually one thing that I would always say to both myself, but all my coaching clients as well, is when you're writing a caption, write it and then leave it for a couple of days, and then use it once you've reread it with a different eye on. Because, you know, we sometimes are rushing to get on like a buzzword or a trending topic that we miss the nuances in our own conversational ability. Yeah. And it's very, very important, like you said, to be aware of how we're wording things so that it can't be taken negatively. So yeah, we all have a responsibility. Again, I guess it comes back to that point we spoke about earlier, it's your sphere of influence. And if you are speaking to like hundreds or thousands of people, we have to be careful about how we do so, because definitely, it's our responsibility.
Yeah, and I think as well, you know, be like aware of our own kind of perspective about this, you know, like, you know, because I think, you know, many of us are in somewhat of a position of kind of privilege and things, and I think we do need to kind of, you know, acknowledge that. So like, I see, you know, say for example, a lot of people talking about, say, body positivity, but I don't always see that many people that kind of acknowledge that actually they might be speaking about that as a kind of like thin white person, right? Which I think is important to acknowledge that, right? And that's not to say you can't have an opinion. Everyone can absolutely have an opinion and a voice on this kind of platform or whatever. But I think we do need to acknowledge, yeah, you know, kind of privilege and our own kind of perspective and experiences and how that will, you know, impact what we're able to share and discuss, you know, as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's worth just putting in there, for anyone who doesn't know, body positivity is actually originated from bigger Black women.
And, yes.
They worked extremely hard to bring body positivity to be their hashtag for promoting different shapes and colours of bodies. And as soon as it gained popularity and momentum, all of the slim white folks jumped on board and kind of overtaken this this train. And yeah, like you said, whilst it's brilliant that everyone's having this awareness about body positivity, we do have to respect the fact that it came from a very different place, and the people using that hashtag, personally, I believe that they should be who started it. So the bigger women, the women who have, I don't know, scars, or the women who are coloured, it's 100% up to them to use it. Personally, I wouldn't use now the hashtag body positivity. I would pick one more so like body confidence, because yeah, body positivity is about sharing very different body styles and shapes. And if you search that hashtag, I would say 50% of what pops up will be the stereotypical health and wellness white woman.
Yeah.
So it's leaving that hashtag to the people who created it, I think, is our responsibility again, in terms of if we're on social media trying to make influence, we need to do it in a way that respects everyone.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like you say, I think people don't know the origins of it and don't think about it as being a movement. They think about it as being a hashtag, or like, you know, being positive if you feel a bit bloated. And it's like, no, it's really much, much deeper than that, you know. And it's fine, and it's great to talk about things like body confidence, and I think, you know, we should do that. But yeah, I completely agree, it's giving kind of respect to those people, and yeah, and the movement as a whole, I think. And yeah, you know, I do think that is important, and I definitely see that gets yeah, that gets missed. So I think that is really important. So yeah, no, thank you so much for enforcing that, I think, because that's, yeah, that is important.
It's responsibility for you.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Because I think, yeah, it's like we've been talking about, right? Some things are like deeper than you realize. And I think, you know, you do have to think about what is behind these things when you look into them, when you know, use a hashtag or whatever, or, you know, or something, do your kind of due diligence and, yeah, and look at, you know, what's behind that, really. So, yeah, for sure. Yeah, so, obviously we talked a bit about you being kind of, like a coach and stuff like that, but, yeah, I was wondering maybe if you could talk just a bit more about, I guess, the kind of ways and stuff that you work with people, like what that looks like.
Yeah, okay. So like I always say, anyone who asks this question, I work with people in three different ways. Mm-hmm. I like my groups of threes, right? So one of the first ways, like you mentioned earlier, I do pain management therapy, which is all about kind of sports massage and a new kind of therapy called amino neurofrequency therapy, or ooh, ANF therapy. So this is, like I said, it helps people manage pain. It's pain management therapy, and that's in person in Bristol, which is where I'm based. Then the second way that I work with people is online through coaching. So that can be a variety of two different ways, one of which is one-on-one coaching with fitness, nutrition, and life coaching. And then the other way is with a course that I run called Transformation Tribe, which is an 8-week course designed to help people overcome their limiting patterns and really kind of like dial in exactly where they want to be, their own definition of where they want to be, understand how they're going to get there, and then to implement that and overcome the obstacles that kind of pop up along the way. So that's the second way that I work with people. And then the third way that I work with people is via Health Bloggers Community, and that is creating networking events for the southwest of England, so Bristol, Bath, and beyond, to bring bloggers, fitness influencers, fitness professionals together into a room to network and connect and kind of build momentum so that, again, we can create more impact and influence in the health and fitness niche online and in person.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Yeah, and I'll just say for the listeners, I did do your Transformate and Tribe course, so I can vouch for the fact that it was amazing. It's just, I think for me, it was really that connecting the dots bit that we've kind of alluded to, like actually the kind of link with kind of who we want to be and stuff with actually kind of how we're approaching kind of food and exercise and our bodies and stuff, you know, because I just think it's so important. And I just think, I don't know, I'm just aware of like how much space is like freed up when then you're not stressing about, you know, your body or like how many calories you've burned or, you know, all this kind of stuff. Actually, you can focus on the stuff that like really matters, you know.
Yeah, it's really, I was so grateful to have you on board that course, and especially with the feedback that you've given about it and everything. I think it's interesting. So this last year, 2018, was when I launched the course for the first time. So I had a small group of people on purpose so that I could monitor them and see how they were using it. Now, this course, originally, it was designed to enable women to overcome this binge restrict cycle. And one of the first things that we do in the course, you'll know, Emma, is obviously figuring out if there are sections within life, for example, adventure and travel, finances, work, wealth, relationships, health. If those sections are the ones that we kind of have to pick from, what are the top three priorities moving forward for that 8 weeks? And out of every single person who did that course, health and fitness and obsessing over food portions was not one of those top three priorities. It was something completely different. And I think that's the kind of thing that we all get very so trapped in, is we want to achieve, you know, I don't know, like brilliance at work, or we want to have really close-knit relationships with our loved ones, or we want a really good community with our friends and family. And we associate that according to our size or our shape or how we look. And again, all of these women who did the course wanted to be better and have a better life and have this ideal definition of what their dream could be. Not one thing of that was attached to how many calories were being eaten in a day. And you're right, it creates so much more space when you're not worrying about that shit to do the things that you really, really want. And, you know, getting that definition down of exactly where you want to be, how you want to look, feel and be in a day or a week or a month, that's just pure magic right there. And that, you know, I feel privileged to be able to help people to do that. It's really, really, I love it. It's so rewarding.
It's amazing. And I think it's just, you know, like having these like tools and these skills and just sometimes just making like small changes, you know, because I think we often think we have to make these like big, drastic, you know, all in kind of changes. And I think, you know, it's these little small things that can kind of, they can kind of add up. And I think what I realized as well is like, you can still improve things, even if they're still like quite good, right? You don't have to like wait until something's like, I think I used to feel like if it's not on fire, like it's fine, you know, like it's sort of that attitude of like, if it's not awful, then, you know, but actually there are, like you say, when we've kind of done this stuff around food and exercise our bodies, we've got that energy that we can work on things that, you know, yes, they're not awful, but actually, you know what, there's some room for improvement, and we can, you know, we can do that, I think. So
at the end of the day, it's about creating space, right? Every single client, I've been a personal trainer for 12 years, right? So every single client I've had wants to change their life, and part of doing so is about changing habits, which takes up more space and more time. And that's where people often fail, is because they feel that they have to go to the gym 3 times a week, they have to do food prep, they have to do all this, which takes so much more time. And it doesn't need to be that complicated. It can be simple, like you said. It's how can you create space in your life so that you have the time and the energy and the resources to be able to do the things that make you feel good. And it's logical stuff, right?
It is.
Sometimes we need a helping hand.
No, yeah, we do. That's the thing. Like, awareness is great, but like awareness on its own isn't going to kind of, you know, cut it, I think. I think that's, You know, that's great. And I love what you said there about as well, but like moving towards kind of something positive as well, because I think that's so important. I think so often people think about what they want to like not be doing, or do you know what I mean? It comes from this kind of like a negative thing, whereas actually I think if you, like psychology, you call it like an approach goal. Do you know what I mean? You're focusing on actually what you do want, not what you don't want. I just think that ends up being so much more empowering. And I think even with the stuff with food, right? You know, I think instead of thinking about, you know, not having stuff, focus on, you know, having more fruit and veg, more, do you know what I mean? You know, or like with exercise, you know, having more energy, you know, I just think that's so much more, you know, yeah, empowering, I think, to, you know.
I think it's worth bearing in mind there as well, that on the other hand, moving away from pain is extremely motivating. So, for example, if you have an injury and you can't walk, it's extremely motivating to get you to go to physical therapy or anything, because you want to be able to walk again. And it's, you have the pain on the one hand, which is pushing you to make action, but then you're also framing it, like you said, in a way that's positive. And it's like, instead of going, oh, I just want to be able to like not sit in my chair all day, it's changing it from I want to not sit in my chair to I want to be up and moving and doing something productive. So yeah, it's about moving away from pain in a way that is positively framed.
Yeah, I agree. No, and I think that's a great point. And I think even with, you know, things like sort of things that are sort of mentally painful, right, that can be a huge driver. And you know, I sometimes wish it wasn't the case, but I think often sometimes to stimulate us to make a change, we sometimes do have to hit a place of pain to encourage that change, you know. Not always, but I think sometimes, you know, sometimes that is just what we need. You know, a rock bottom or whatever, which sounds dramatic, but I think that can be very different on different people. But you know, I think sometimes we do need that, but again, not always. And I think that's why this kind of awareness and this mindfulness and stuff that I feel like I bang about all the time, like, is just so valuable, because I think then you don't have to get to a point where things are awful to make a change, because you have that, oh, this is, you know what, this is something that's coming up for me that I can work on, you know. Whereas when you don't have that awareness, it's almost like it's got to be awful before you even realize there's a problem, you know.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, there's so many ways and routes that you can change. It's finding a way that works for you as an individual. So again, and that just comes from speaking to people, from having these open conversations, from experience, like reading other people's stories. So important. So I just, yeah, connection with other people, and not making an isolation out of yourself when you know, you feel like you are in a place that you need to feel change, even though that's sometimes the hardest thing to do. If you're kind of like depressed or you're in the eating disorder place, it's so hard. You do really want to isolate yourself, and the best thing that you can do is, you know, just connect with people, drop someone a text, get on social media, start up a conversation with someone, just say hi. It might feel very scary and very unachievable, but do the small steps to be able to make change in a way that makes you feel comfortable.
Yeah, oh, I completely agree. And I think the thing is as well, sometimes other people don't even have to have the answers, but I think even just being listened to, it can actually help us figure things out ourselves and be really helpful. It reminds me, I had a conversation with my parents recently about, you know, when kind of I was ill and with, you know, an eating disorder, and my mom said that it was really difficult because she felt like she couldn't do anything. And I said, you know, what was really helpful was the fact that you made an effort to understand. I said that was huge for me, because I was still figuring it out in my own head, but actually just having someone that I could talk to about it really kind of openly and honestly, I think is huge. So I think that's the other thing, and that's, you know, other people around us may well be able to kind of help us, but even if they can only listen, that in itself is hugely valuable, I think. So yeah, reach out, people.
Anyone listening, if you want to talk, I am on the end of an Instagram account or a Facebook account, so feel free to jump in and have a chat. I will never turn anyone away. So.
Oh, and that is such a good segue. So what is your Instagram and your Facebook and all the other places that we can find you?
Yeah, so basically I have a blog, which is N for November, L for Lima, perform, nlperform.com. My Instagram is Cam Dempster, CamDemPster, and then an underscore. And then I have a Facebook group called Fitness Tips and Tricks, which if you go to Facebook, Google search, Fitness Tips and Tricks, you should hopefully find me in there. If not, like, really the best place to find me is Instagram. So find me on Instagram, and then there's links from Instagram to everywhere that you kind of need to be.
Sounds good. Yeah, and I'll make sure that's in the show notes as well. I just like to kind of spell it out in case people are listening, and then they can do it straight away. You don't even have to read anything. So yeah, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a really good conversation, and
I've enjoyed it, and I hope anyone listening has gleaned a little bit of insight as to how to deal with these kind of issues. So thank you for the opportunity, Emma. It's been amazing.
Oh, you're so welcome. Yeah, great, cool. Well, yeah, thank you everyone for listening. Hope it was helpful. We'd love to have some feedback, both from me and Camilla, on the socials, so let us know. That would be great.
Share it if you like it.
Yes. I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. I'd really appreciate it if you took 2 minutes and just gave me a review, positive or negative. I'd love to find out what you enjoyed, what you didn't, so that I can put together the best possible podcast. And it also helps it to go up in rankings so that other people can discover the podcast too. Thank you.